Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. There are a lot of topics I could spend the hour or part of the hour on this week related to breaking news. Surely our hearts and indignation swell in response to the condominium collapse in Florida, which now appears to have been the product of negligence on the part of the building's owners and state regulators. We cringe at the thought of yet another heat wave in the west and southwest as parts of central Arizona are still smoldering from huge wildfires, crops and native plants are dying in California, and later rains will therefore bring a threat of catastrophic mudslides and flooding. The Supreme Court just completed the evisceration of the Voting Rights Act by overturning a lower court's ruling that restrictive laws adopted by the gerrymandered Republican majority in the Arizona legislature disproportionately affect minorities, people of color and the elderly. And students. Basically, the court didn't disagree that those constituents are disproportionately impacted. They just ruled that it didn't matter. So separate but allegedly equal but not really equal voting rights are now the prevailing paradigm, unless or until Congress adopts the John Lewis and For the People Voting Rights Acts, now being held up in the Senate by West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona. And in Ohio, the state budget, passed by our own gerrymandered Republican majority, includes a provision that allows service providers to decline to provide services on everything from surgery to and medications to baking a wedding cake to anyone on the basis of unspecified moral, religious, or philosophical objections. In other words, the social contract that prohibits discrimination now means essentially nothing. And some on the far right claim that Governor DeWine is a liberal, as if they ever actually speak with liberals. Unless to ridicule them. The state budget also includes burdensome restrictions on wind and solar development that no other forms of energy generation are required to comply with, in what environmentalists see as a wholesale assault on renewable energy. Who needs Larry Householder when Republicans hold the House? And of course, Governor DeWine is facing challenges from the right within his own party, among them the inimitable Jim Renacci, who in the last week or so has been plastering his social media outlets with attacks on DeWine over the issue of critical race theory. You may recall that there are two bills authored nationally by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, that would prohibit public school teachers from teaching about racism in a way that might be seen as too provocative. Although critical race theory per se is not being taught or even proposed in public schools, it's more of a college-level discourse, really, these bills and their advocates say that the critical race theory is a threat. Renacci even went so far as to claim in a Facebook meme that eight members of the Ohio State Board of Education, all appointed by DeWine, he alleges, voted unanimously, he says, in support of teaching critical race theory in the state's K-12 curriculum. Now, if that had actually happened, wouldn't you think that that would have made the news? I looked at the agendas and the minutes of every State Board of Election, State Board of Education meeting for this year and found no mention of critical race theory at all, though several board members have spoken out in favor of banning it, even though it hasn't been proposed. Indeed, a more thorough search of the State Board's website with its archives of documents and official business reveals one possible candidate for what Renacci might be referring to, a resolution adopted a year ago against racism, which acknowledges racial disparities in education and sets forth pretty broad and unspecific guidelines for how to address it. It really doesn't say much about any curriculums, but it does speak about the need to include culturally inclusive instruction. It identifies equity as the main goal. Well, what does that mean? A classic illustration of equity is where you have three people attending a baseball game, one tall, one of average height, and one short, and they attempt to watch the game by peering over a fence. The tall one has no trouble. The average one can see by standing on tiptoes, but the short one's view is blocked. Equality is essentially that. All three have equal access to the game, just not equal resources to contend with the obstacle. Equity shows the average person with a small platform and the short person with a taller boost, so that all three can enjoy an equal view. Equity, in that regard, means distributing the needed resources to lift those more severely challenged to a level of parity. That, it seems, that word, that very concept, is the main sticking point for people like Renacci and his followers with critical race theory. as it too mentions equity. These people don't like to be called racists, but they fundamentally object to equality if equity is required to achieve it. Well, here to explain that in greater detail is renowned author and historian Ibrahim Kendi.
Good morning, everyone. In this time, as an educator, it's one of those times in which we're trying to sort of figure out our role, our mission, our destiny. And so for me to be invited to sort of help you along that course, again, I'm truly honored. And I just want to thank, of course, the staff at Unbound Ed for this invitation, as well as for reading Stamp from the beginning. Over the past year, I understand there's been some fascinating and heavy and enlightening discussions. And I want to really, before I begin my speech, because I wasn't really going to talk specifically about Stamp from the beginning, especially since I have a new book about to come out entitled How to Be an Anti-Racist. But I did want to share with you who haven't had the ability to read this upwards of 500-year history of racist ideas. Or for those of you who are like, that book's too long, so I'm not reading it. for me to sort of share what I learned from recording the entire history of anti-black racist ideas. I didn't want to just chronicle this history. I wanted to understand what impact these ideas have had over the course of modern history. What was the purpose behind these ideas? Where did these ideas come from? And I say that last question because we have often been taught that those who express and produce racist ideas do so because of their own ignorance and hate. In other words, when I'm in DC and some of the powerful people with bully pulpits say things that people consider racist, the typical response is, he must be ignorant. She must be hateful. And that's why they're producing this idea that Latinx immigrants are animals and rapists. That's why they're producing this idea that black people live in hell. That's why they're producing this idea that even unarmed black bodies are dangerous. Because they're ignorant and hateful. They just don't know. That's why they're producing this idea that there's widespread voter fraud, particularly in places like Philadelphia and Cleveland and other major cities in swing states that just happen to have a large concentration of people of color. That there's just widespread voter fraud. Anybody know what I'm talking about? These ideas, they produce these ideas that there's this pervasiveness of welfare queens, or that certain people of color are not taking personal responsibility. And they say these things, we believe, because they are ignorant and hateful. That's what we've been taught. And so I wanted to figure out, is that the case? Is the source of people producing these racist ideas over the course of time, whether racist ideas like slavery is a positive good for black people, or whether a racist idea that the reason why 40% of the incarcerated population in this country is black is because black people are so criminal-like, is because their neighborhoods are so dangerous, is because they would rather choose prison than college. I wanted to figure out, was it that ignorance and hate was behind these ideas? And as I studied the emergence and production of these ideas, when I understood them in their historical context, when I identified the actual individuals who first produced or mass circulated these ideas, I found that these are who's who of American intellectuals. That these are some of the most brilliant American minds. That many of these people had close relationships with black people, were considered friends of the Negro, even had sexual relationships with black people. Anybody know what I'm talking about? And so I found that what was actually happening was that these producers of racist ideas were typically producing them not out of ignorance and hate, but to justify existing racist policies that typically benefited them. In other words, when you have a racist policy, that policy creates racial inequity. If you are benefiting from that racist policy, do you want people to think the cause of that racial inequity is your policy that benefits you, or do you want people to think that the cause of that racial inequity is the inferiority of, let's say, black people? Which one do you want? You would want people to believe that the cause of these racial inequities are the inferiorities and superiorities of particular racial groups, so that people will look out at racial inequity and inequality in our society and see normality, not see anything wrong. And in not seeing anything wrong, they're not going to look for, let alone identify, let alone challenge the very racist policies that benefit you. You see how that works? I want people to believe that there's widespread voter fraud so people won't seek to identify, let alone challenge, these new voter ID laws that allow me to maintain my political seat. So they won't challenge these massive voter purges. So they won't challenge these mechanisms that make it such that people in poor black neighborhoods have to wait hours in order to vote. Anyway, I can get carried away, but and so that's the history that I share. I don't share a history of racist ideas, of ignorance and hate leading to racist ideas, and then people who have these racist ideas instituting racist policies. I actually tell a history of the inverse, of people typically out of self-interest, political, economic, even cultural or professional self-interest, instituting or defending racist policies and then producing racist ideas to justify, to rationalize, to normalize those racist policies. And then those racist ideas are consumed by the masses of Americans, and then they start believing those things, and then that belief causes the ignorance and hate. In other words, the consumption of racist ideas causes people to become ignorant and hateful, as opposed to the other way around. And so that's the history that I share in Stamp from the Beginning, which is another reason why the book was a little bit long. It's quite complex, right? Telling this story that is enduring, telling this history that is living, telling this history that we can still see each day, even in our classrooms, schools, school districts, and communities. But I've been asked to talk to you today about how to strive to be an anti-racist educator and even leader. And in writing Stamp from the Beginning, I didn't just want to write a history of racist ideas and the origins of those ideas. I wanted to really show that America's racial history of ideas is really an argument or a debate between racist and anti-racist ideas. That Americans from the beginning of this country, and even before the emergence of this country, during colonial America or even in Western Europe, that people were trying to answer a central question. Why does racial inequality exist? And people have been debating that for upwards of 500 years. Racists have historically said, because certain groups are superior and other groups are inferior. That is the reason why you have racial inequality. Anti-racists have historically said, the racial groups are equals. And since they are equals, The cause of racial inequality must be racist policy. That has been the central conflict in American racial history. The cause of racial inequality. Some saying it's because of racial hierarchy, and others saying because of racist policy. Now, you see in that sort of debate between racist and anti-racist, there's really no room for the not racist. And what I'm talking about is, in our time, just like across American history, when Americans have been charged with being racist, their typical response is, I'm not racist. Anybody know what I'm talking about? It doesn't matter who they are, whether they're a slaveholder, whether they're a Ku Klux Klansman, whether they're a congressman from Iowa who says, what's wrong with the term white supremacy? And in that very same New York Times article, he's quoted as saying, I'm not racist. It doesn't matter who they are, what they support, what ideas they express. When they are charged with being racist, their response is, I'm not racist. And they hate it when I say that. And they really do. And the reason why they hate it is because I don't say, no, you are racist. My response is, okay, well, what is a not racist? What is the history of not racism? I know what a racist is. I know what an anti-racist is. What is a not racist? What is a not racist idea? Racist ideas express racial hierarchy. Anti-racist ideas express racial equality. Racist policies yield racial inequity. Anti-racist policies yield racial equity. Racist people express racist ideas and support racist policies through their actions or even inaction. I'm not going to do nothing, and then racial inequity reproduces. And anti-racists express anti-racist ideas and support anti-racist policies with their action. With that formulation, what is a not racist? There's no in-between of hierarchy and equality. Any math whizzes? You have this and this. There's no in-between that, right? There's no in-between a policy that yields racial inequity and a policy that yields racial equity. There's no such thing as a race-neutral policy. There's no such thing as a race-blind policy. And I say that because we have been taught to understand racism in a popular sense by the practitioners of racism. What I mean by that, in the mid-1960s, when Congress and Americans more broadly were debating over the Civil Rights Act, and after the Civil Rights Act and even Voting Rights Act was passed, one of the ways in which racism progressed was to make the case that the way we identify a racist person, or even a racist idea, or even a racist policy, is through the intention of the policy, person, or idea. In other words, if there's no racial language in the policy, then it clearly did not intend to create all of that racial inequity. If the person says, I'm not racist, then apparently they must not be racist. If a person did not know that that idea that they keep expressing is racist, then how can we call them racist? That wasn't their intention. And when you situate intention as the way to define racism, what does it allow? It allows an easy defense. Just like for those of us who are in relationships, When we say something or do something that's messed up, what do we say? Oh, that wasn't my intention. Right? To try to smooth it over. It's a defensive mechanism. Because nobody can get in our minds and say, no, that was your intention. Where's your evidence? You have no evidence that that was my intention. I'm sure y'all have had this argument before. Right? You can't, it's hard to prove intention. But it's not hard to prove outcome. It's not hard to prove that a policy is creating racial inequity. It's not hard to prove that a person believes that the cause of racial inequity is the inferiorities of a particular group. To give an example, we're debating, Americans and New Yorkers are debating over whether to eliminate that standardized test. That is the sole mechanism that allows for students to get into high schools. Anybody know what I'm talking about? And so those who are defending the test, listen very clearly to how they're defending the test. What do they say? They say, well, the kids who scored highly, I'm sorry, the kids who didn't score highly, they should have studied harder. They should have not have played as much basketball. They should be more focused on their education. What are they saying? That the reason why only a handful of black kids have gotten into Stuyvesant for this upcoming year is because there's something wrong with black kids. That's the argument. They don't even have to say black kids or Latinx kids or the superiority of white kids or even Asian kids to make that point. Because the cause of that inequity is, again, either the inferiorities or superiorities of particular groups or policy, or that test prep companies are concentrated in certain neighborhoods. I didn't mean to go there, but. and so this idea that there is a not racist, or that there's a such thing as not racism, is I've been searching for that history, that conception, ever since I started researching STAMP from the beginning. And over the course of time, all I have been able to find is that the not racist is in denial about his or her own racism. All I've been able to find is that the heartbeat of racism itself is denial. That's the heartbeat. And in contrast, the heartbeat of anti-racism is confession. So the racist completely denies that their nation is racist, that they were raised to be racist, that they were nurtured to be racist, that it is normal to be racist, and therefore, because they were raised, nurtured, and born and raised in a racist nation, it's more than likely they're going to grow to be a racist. No, they completely deny that. While an anti-racist says, you know what? It is difficult for a person born and raised and nurtured in this society to be anti-racist. It is unbelievably hard. It is unbelievably hard for us, because we are constantly taught that the problem of our society are people, are those people who don't look like us, not policy. And it's easy to understand the inferiorities of people as the cause of racial inequities because we constantly see it. We constantly see lazy black kids. But what we don't understand is we see lazy white kids too. It just so happens when we see that lazy black kid, what do? We generalize it to say that the cause of his laziness is his blackness. While when we see that lazy white kid in the classroom, we're like, well, what's going on with him today? Did he not have enough sleep last night? Was I too hard on her? In other words, there's something going on with that individual. I can remember in third grade, I grew up born and raised in Jamaica, Queens. Anybody here from Queens? Okay, Queens. My parents put me in a Lutheran private school for third grade. I had just moved out of public school from kindergarten to second grade, and they decided to put me in this Lutheran private school. That's another discussion. And I can remember that our classroom, the majority of the students were Black and Latinx, and we had probably a third highest number of students were Asian, and then I remember we had three white students out of probably a class of 20 or 25. And I can remember in that class how the three white students were more or less ordered by the white teacher to sit near the front. I can remember how the teacher, of course, the way that she sort of taught was to, you know, constantly sort of ask us questions about different matters that she was teaching on. And of course, children, we'd raise our hands. And I can remember her typically calling on those white students, even if a Black or Latinx or Asian student raised their hand before they did, even if they had just engaged with that white student. I saw those preferences, and I thought that they were a problem. But I think in many ways, I guess, many of the students took it in stride. And it did not seem to be a problem to many of my classmates. But one day, this small, petite Black girl who rarely raised her hand, she was very, very quiet, but something about what we were talking about that day, or what the teacher asked, caused her to shoot up her hand before anyone. And I looked over to her because we were both sitting towards the back of the classroom and she was on the other side. And I could see her excitement to express whatever she wanted to express. The teacher looked at her and then called on a white student. And then I saw her hand go down, and I saw her spirits go down. And I became irate. After that sort of session, since it was a Lutheran school, we had to go to chapel almost every day. And so we went to chapel. And at the end of the chapel, I sat towards the back of the sanctuary. That's becoming a little pattern, right? And the teacher was leading the other students out. And as she came upon me and asked me to leave, I said, I'm not going anywhere. And she looked down at me and basically ordered me to leave. And I shot back and said, I'm not going anywhere. She asked me again to leave. And I responded again to say, I'm not going anywhere. By that point, she was angry and I was angry. At no point during that initial exchange did she say to me, Ibram, what's wrong? And when I reflect on that moment, I always think about, if I would have been one of her favorite white students, would she have asked me, what's wrong? We, of course, one of the things we're talking about in education, and we've been talking about for quite some time, are the massive amounts of disparities in the way in which different children are punished. In which Black children, even as early as preschool, are 3 times more likely to be suspended than white preschool students. And it just continues over the course of schooling. And you know, one of the things that I think we don't talk about is how when a black child misbehaves, and I'm not going to say I wasn't misbehaving, but when a black child misbehaves, it is assumed too often that she is misbehaving, that he is misbehaving because of their blackness. That's what black kids do. They misbehave. They come from broken homes and broken families and broken communities. So the question, a simple question of what is going on with you? Even though all of the data in the social science points to the way in which conditions or what's happening in a child's life affects how they behave. In other words, they don't get sleep. Any sort of thing could lead to misbehavior. Instead of asking that question for the black child, many teachers become punitive immediately, which of course only accelerates the situation. And so then the way in which we experience that teacher in third grade becomes very similar to the way we experience that white police officer when we're 25. And the teacher and the police officer effectively become the same person. Which is why we talk about the school-to-prison pipeline. It, in many ways, it's not even a pipeline. It's the same thing. We are seen fundamentally as deviant. And so, y'all want to hear the end of that story? So, of course, she went, actually, before I end the story, I think what's critical about that story is to talk about the way in which a racist and an anti-racist teacher will respond. Again, the racist teacher, when a black child or a Latinx child misbehaves, they don't ask questions. When a white child misbehaves, they do, whether to the child or even internally. And can you see how the lack of questions for that black or Latinx child can lead to a punishment, while the fact that we ask those questions for that white child would not? Because we begin to realize what is really going on. Now, she probably would not have liked my answer if she would have asked me what was going on. But this is the way in which, particularly as it relates to punishment in classrooms and in schools, this is the way in which black children are too often treated as adults. And black adults, we know, are treated like what? Children. And so the child deserves the question. And if we're not asking that question, if we're chalking up their misbehavior to their blackness or to their race, or if we're even chalking up their behaving well to their race, to their gender and race, that's also a problem too. If we imagine that let's say black girls behave better than black boys, or black boys behave better than black girls, or white girls behave better than white boys, that is going to affect how we respond to misbehavior. Those ideas. And so she, of course, left after ordering me, after realizing that I wasn't going to leave. And she went and got the principal. And as she got the principal, I sort of started, was in the chapel by myself, and I started sort of rehearsing in many ways, my first dissertation on racism. And so the principal came, and the principal ordered me to leave. I refused. The principal ordered me to leave again. I refused again. And then finally, this principal asked me, "What's wrong?" And then I told her. And it led to a conversation. Ultimately, later in the day, of course, they called up my mother to school. My father typically didn't come up to school in these types of incidents because he always would defend me no matter what. My mother was more even-keeled, and so they had decided that it was better for her to go up to these schools. And of course, they told her that behavior is prohibited. We'll suspend him next time. We'll expel him next time. And, you know, so she came home and told me that. But what was absolutely critical that she also told me that night, and I think this was probably one of the best lessons I ever received, and this is the type of lesson we can even share to our students. And this lesson that she said to me was, "I'm not going to tell you not to protest, but you have to understand that there are going to be consequences when you do. So if you choose to do it, you also choose to accept the consequences. And if you choose not to, then you'll also be affected in that way." And so what it did is it allowed me to take responsibility, to recognize the effects of my actions, whether positive or negative. And of course, as you would imagine, I didn't stop. But I also recognized from that point forward that the problem that I was having largely ceased with that teacher. I don't know what my parents said to them behind the scenes. I don't know what the principal said to that teacher behind the scenes. But I do know that, for the most part, that teacher changed. Probably my father went up there. And in many ways, my educational life changed the next year. When, of course, as y'all would imagine, they took me out of that school. And they put me in another Episcopalian school. that was closer to home. And I should also add that at the time, this is the late 80s, early 90s in New York City, that my parents largely sort of came out of poverty. My father was born and raised in the projects in Flushing. My mother had more of a working class family. They both were able to move into this new black middle class that emerged in the 70s and 80s. And in many ways, that black middle class began to start separating their children from working and working poor black children in public schools in the way white middle class people were separating their children from all of us. And I talk about this in How to Be an Anti-Racist, the ways in which, in many ways, I was raised to think that there was a problem with poor black people. And I should also say that when I define a racist idea, I define a racist idea as any idea that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group in any way. And when I say racial group, the black poor are a racial group. When we say the black poor, when we imagine the black poor as opposed to the poor, we are imagining a racialized group. We are specifically saying things about the black poor that we don't believe about white poor people, that we don't believe about poor people more broadly. And each race is a collection of racial groups. And so you have the black poor, black elites. You have black women, black men. You have white women, white men. You have so-called white trash, as white elites call them, in a denigrating way. And then you have white elites, right? You have white gays and black gays. And so when we think about being an anti-racist, when we think about treating our students equitably, seeing all of them as having equal value, seeing them all as having the similar capabilities for achievement, I'm not just talking about us seeing black children and white children in similar ways. I'm talking about seeing that poor black child as having the same capabilities as that rich white child. And so even within racial groups, we recycle racist ideas about other racial groups within our race. And so the ideas that black elites have about the black poor are quite similar to the ideas that white elites have about the white poor. That they are in their position because of their hard work, because of their intelligence, because of their superior cultural and behavioral acumen, not because of the confluence of racist and even elitist policies that affect poor people. I keep going on all these tangents. I'm so sorry. And so in fourth grade, you know, that third grade teacher, after our incident, she pretty much just left me alone. She was like, okay, I'm just going to leave that black radical alone. I'm just not going to say anything to him. He ain't going to say anything to me. And, you know, I did okay, but it wasn't really until fourth grade. And my teacher in fourth grade, Mrs. Miles, that I really began to excel as a student. In fourth grade, Mrs. Miles was the most encouraging, was the most understanding, was the most strict, and was the most intelligent teacher I ever had. You see that combination of being extremely strict, no, I'm gonna hold you to these high standards, but at the same time, when you fall below them, I'm going to be understanding. That I'm gonna see you for who you are, not based on how you look. That I'm gonna push you harder than you ever pushed yourself. But then sometimes when you get tired, I'm going to hug you. This was Mrs. Miles. And I can say that in terms of my academic career, that was the height of my academic career. I actually got 100s on all of my finals. I'll never forget that. It went downhill after that. Especially when I was a freshman in high school, I was on the JV basketball team as a freshman, and I never forget, after practice one day, our JV basketball coach comes into the locker room, we're changing, and says to us that in order for y'all to stay on this team, you have to earn 2 C's and 3 D's. So make sure you get 2 C's and 3 D's. And I was an extremely impressionable and gullible child. And what I mean by that is, I in many ways, I am deeply critical of myself for this, but at the same time, I recognize that I was quite normal. In other words, the environment that the teacher created for me, that the mentor, that the authority figure created for me, was typically the place that I was going to stand in. That was me as a child. that if somebody had high standards for me, I was going to run up to those standards. If somebody looked at me as a threat, I was going to act like a threat. If someone had low standards for me, I was going to do what I did freshman year and get 2 C's and 3 D's. And then after I got those 2 C's and 3 D's, especially because in my public high school in Queens, teachers were checked out. You know, we would have our own classroom discussions in the back of the class that had nothing to do with what the teacher was teaching, and the teacher didn't care. No one took me aside to ask me about my academic performance. I mean, there were 4,000 kids at my high school. How could anybody do that anyway? And as a result of my academic performance, or lack thereof, the confidence that I had as a student in fourth grade had hit its all-time low. My parents decided that they were going to move us out of New York City to Northern Virginia. And so I went from living in this pretty much all-black neighborhood to living in this majority white suburb. So it was a massive cultural shock. But simultaneously, my insecurities about my own academic performance only deepened, particularly when teachers and even other students began to reinforce my own ideas about myself. And it wasn't until 12th grade, and by that point, mind you, I didn't really think I was going to college. I'm like, why would any college accept an idiot? It wasn't until 12th grade that a friend of mine encouraged me to become a part of this Martin Luther King oratorical contest that encouragement led me to actually write a speech and win the school competition, which then led to this black male guidance counselor taking me under his wing to prepare for us to compete at the county level. And so every day after school, I would go and work with him on my speech. But in many ways, I was working with him on my own academic competence. In many ways, I was working with him on my life. Because it wasn't really, I didn't really have anyone that believed in me, that pushed me, since Mrs. Miles. I mean, my parents, of course, did, but, I mean, they're your parents, like. And so I began, as I went through the process of preparing for that competition at the county level, which I ultimately won, believing that maybe I wasn't stupid. Maybe I wasn't stupid. I had dropped out of an English IB 2 course before enrolling in that competition because I felt the class was too hard for me. And what's interesting was the actual teacher, after I ended up winning that competition, she couldn't reconcile how I could drop out of that class and how I could win that competition against students who were competing against students who were going to some of the top schools in the country. And so I'm saying this all to say that our role as educators is one of the most critical roles in this country. And I'm sure that's not something, hopefully, that you all don't already know. But how we affect that child in that classroom, in that moment, can set the course of that child for the rest of that child's life. And if we are being a racist, if we are being a racist, if we are not taking the time to confront our own ideas about race, if we are not taking the time to look in the mirror and see what are the racist ideas that I've consumed about this racial group, about that racial group, what are the racist ideas that I have about Black children, about Latinx children, if we're not doing that work, then every time we're leading a school or leading a classroom discussion, we are part of the problem. We are damaging minds. And so fundamentally, we have to ask ourselves, who do we want to strive to be? Who do we want to strive to be? Literally, American teachers are nurtured and trained to be racist. Whether it's based on how we understand that there's a such thing as an academic achievement gap, that Black children and Latinx children are achieving at a lower level than white children because they come from broken homes and broken communities and broken families and broken cultures and broken nations. But that, you know what, we can fix those cultures and families and communities and nations and civilize those children, while others say, no, that's impossible because they're genetically predisposed to stupidity. And then those two groups are arguing over why these Black children are so academically inferior. And the group that's saying, no, it's their environment, is imagining themselves as progressive. But what if it's the case that there's nothing wrong with that child and there's everything wrong with the test? What if that's the case? Or what if it's the case that no excuse is schools? This idea that a 7-year-old, 11-year-old, cannot explain why they're misbehaving, but a 31-year-old white rapist can and get off. Can you imagine this sort of contradiction? I was just reading the other day, right, about this white rapist in the New York metro area, I believe in New Jersey, who is not going to receive, who the judge advocated should not receive jail time because he comes from a good family and he goes to good schools. And so this, you know, we shouldn't bury his life. And that he just made a mistake. I mean, to be white is to have the ability to constantly make mistakes, to constantly express excuses. And then people of color do not have that right. We are not giving these children second and third and fourth chances. And if we can't give a child third and fourth chances, who can we give chances to? And so the fundamental question is, who are we going to strive to be? Are we going to strive to be a racist educator who looks out at all these inequities, whether along academic or even lines of punishment, and then blame the children for those inequities, and then say that's just normal, that's just the way those kids are? Their parents don't really care about education. They don't really care about education. All they care about is playing football. Or are we going to identify the way in which those ideas have been reproduced in our own minds? Are we going to confess the way in which we have been raised to be racist? Are we going to begin the process of getting rid of those ideas, confronting our own ideas? And then in confronting our own ideas, are we going to begin the process of saying, no, the racial groups are equals? And so all of these disparities and inequities in my school, in my classroom, in my school district, in my neighborhood is not because of people. It's because of policies. Are we going to be the anti-racist who figures out what are those policies that are causing those inequities or lack thereof? Are we going to be that anti-racist who becomes a part of that struggle, those groups of people who are already in our schools, who are already in our neighborhoods, challenging those racist policies? Or are we going to be that anti-racist who puts anti-racist policies in place, replacing those racist policies? Are we going to be the anti-racist who, when those policies we thought were anti-racist do not yield more racial equity, that we don't blame the children and say, well, we put the policies in place? Are we going to be the anti-racist who says, there must be something wrong with our policies? We have to try again until we get this to work. Are we going to be that type of person? Because we need that type of person in our classrooms. There's so much at stake in the minds of Americans. Racist ideas are in many ways our common sense, and they are taught to children not only by the media, not only by parents, but by teachers. Who are we going to be? What part of history are we going to be on? Because as you would imagine, 100 years from now, y'all know how historians are going to be writing about this time. And which force are we going to be on? Now, some would say, and I'm going to shut up, some would say that I agree with you, Ibram. We should look at these racial groups as equal. But racism is so pervasive and systemic and structural and deep in education, let alone society, that why would I waste my time trying to transform a nation that has been racist as long as this nation has? Trying to do that is impossible. I am not going to be part of that struggle because it's bound to fail. I have lost all hope, especially when I look at what's happening in Washington, D.C. And what I would say in response, I'm sorry, I'm having a little conversation here. What I would say in response is that once we lose hope, racism is guaranteed. That cynicism, that form of cynicism, is like the kryptonite of change. That we imagine we're so smart as we say it's not going to change, when in fact we are part of the forces that are ensuring that change would never happen. One of the principal functions of racist ideas is to get people to believe that inequality is normal and permanent. So at the very time that we're imagining we're so anti-racist, reckoning how pervasive racism really is, and then saying because it's so bad and horrible, it can never be changed, we are actually furthering racism. Thank you.
That was Ibram Kendi speaking 1 year ago on the general issue of racism in our society and our culture. This has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.